back. All Hit Radio.
Welcome to the X Zone, a place where fact is fiction and fiction is reality. Now, here's your host, Rob Vicano.
Good evening, one and all, and welcome to the X-Zone. I am Rob McConnell, and we're coming to you from our broadcast center and studios in Crystal Beach, Ontario, Canada. Now, if you'd like to send me an email, X-Zone at XZoneRadioTV.com, on all social media sites, X-Zone Radio TV. And for all the programming that we have available for you, 724-365 on the X-Zone Broadcast Network, visit www.xzbn.net and the X-Zone TV channel. That is accessible to more than 74 million people around the world, is exclusive to SimulTV at www.simultv.com. Exonation, my guest this hour is Thomas J. Carey. He is a native Philadelphian, holds degrees from Temple University and California State in Sacramento, and he also attended the University of Toronto and their PhD program in anthropology. An Air Force veteran who held a top secret crypto clearance, Tom is now a retired Philadelphia area businessman. He has been a Mutual UFO Network state section director for southeastern Pennsylvania from 1986 until 2001, a special investigator for the J. Allen Hynek Center for UFO Studies from 1991 to 2001, and a member of the QFO's board of directors from 1997 to 2001. Now, Tom began investigating aspects of the Roswell incidents in 1991 for the Roswell investigative team of Kevin Randall and Don Schmidt. And as you know, Kevin Randall has a show on the X-Zone Broadcast Network. And it's always great having people from Kevin's show over on this show. And Tom, I've had the pleasure of producing the shows that you've done with Kevin. And I must tell you, the work that you do is very interesting.
Yes, I did. Hello.
Yes, I'm here, Tom.
Yeah, I have a little echo. Since you and I talked last, which has been a couple of years, mm-hmm. Rob. Yeah. Actually, I've done Kevin's show twice, and of course, we talked about Roswell. The one show we talked about that. The so-called Roswell slide fiasco that we had down in Mexico City,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
About 5-6 years ago, and the second show we did like a reminisce, because we go back 30 years with Kevin and Don.
That's quite some time, man.
Yes. So when you first start, I remember, in fact, I was talking to Don today, and we were sort of reminiscing, and, it's been so long, everybody's dead.
Mm-hmm.
I remember saying, boy, my first trip to Roswell was in 1993. And I was down there, and I said, okay, well, I've been down here. I guess that's it. We'll wrap it up now. And, here it is, 30 years later. We're still on the case, although you have to understand, and I'm sure you do, that most everybody is gone now. Even some of the children of the participants from 1947, they're
yeah.
passing away. And Don and I are getting up there. So it's really sobering, because every time we go down to Roswell, which is at least once a year, every July they have the festival,
mm-hmm.
except last year because of the COVID, we didn't have one. But every time we go down there, we find that someone else has passed away. And it's almost like family, Rob, when you know these people. And
mm-hmm.
for so long, it's almost like a member of your family has passed away.
Don, tell me, why is the myth of Roswell or the incident at Roswell, the crash at Roswell, still so prevalent when it comes to ufology? You'd think that since 1947, it would have been solved one way or another. And yet here we are, the year 2021, and the investigation continues.
Well, Rob, that's a good question. And the simple answer is that we believe we have solved the case. Mm-hmm. But the only thing that we're missing is a physical and incontrovertible physical piece of evidence, like a steering wheel or a, you know, the dashboard from the ship. That's the fallback position of people who doubt what took place. Well, show me a piece of physical evidence.
Right.
Well, we don't have it, but we do have over 600 witnesses that know pieces of the story that we have assembled. We've interviewed and assembled into a, like you're putting a puzzle together. Mm-hmm. And we believe that we have at least solved the what happened. The evidence is the testimony, because testimony is evidence, as you know, in a court of law.
Yep.
If it's credible testimony, it serves as evidence. And sometimes if it's, you know, extremely well articulated, it mm-hmm. serves as a proof. So,
well, let me ask you this. Based on the investigation that you've done over the past 30 years, what do you believe, based on the testimony, the witnesses that you've interviewed, what happened that day in 1947 in Roswell, New Mexico?
Well, late in the evening of July the 2nd, it took us a couple of years to figure out what date it was. Late in the evening of July the 2nd, there was a severe thunder and lightning storm mm-hmm. over central New Mexico. It's their, what they call their monsoon season. The July of every year is their monsoon season. And we have it from several witnesses that between the thunderclaps, they heard a muffled explosion of some sort that wasn't a thunderclap. And they wonder, what is that? And the next day, a rancher by the name of Mac Brazel, who was the foreman of a sheep ranch near Corona, the town of Corona, he's out checking fence, and lo and behold, he comes across a big field of strange debris. Looked like, silvery, like aluminum, very light, something that he had never seen before. And what had happened was a ship, we believe, had, if it was an internal explosion, we don't know what sort of explosion it was, but it exploded in the air, struck by lightning or exploded some way, that it rained down these small pieces of debris over Mac Brazel's sheep pasture. Mm-hmm. And he found it the morning of July the 3rd. And he had another person with him, a young 9-year-old boy named Timothy D. Proctor was with him. And so it was, everything was in just small pieces there. No bodies, just small pieces. And he's wondering, what is this? And so he, this is July the 3rd. So 2 days later, mm-hmm. he goes into town on July the 6th. That would be Sunday. So I guess it's 3 days later. He wants to know who's going to clean up that stuff, because his sheep won't cross the pasture to get to water. So who's going to clean up that stuff? And, he goes into Roswell, goes into the sheriff's office. While he's talking to the sheriff, a fellow by the name of Frank Joyce, who's spinning records on the local radio station, calls the sheriff's office for, hey, George, and the sheriff's name was George Wilcox. Hey, George, you got anything I can put on the radio? Anything interesting? He says, well, yeah, I've got a guy here named Brazel. He says he found some strange material out there. He thinks it's a crash flying saucer. And so he interviews Brazel, and neither one of them, Wilcox or Frank Joyce, believe Brazel at that point.
Let me ask you a question at this point. Why did Brazel think that it was a flying saucer?
Well, he had talked to, before he went to Roswell, he went to Wade's Bar in Corona on Saturday night, and he took a piece of that metal with him. And Brazel hadn't heard of flying saucers. He, you know, because he did no radio, no electricity there. They get a weekly or monthly newspaper. So he never heard of flying saucers. But some of the fellas at the bar said, well, hey, Mac, maybe it's from one of those flying saucer things. You know, there's all kinds of newspaper headlines going around about these things they call flying saucers. Mm-hmm. Maybe that piece of metal that is acting funny, you know, they're trying to, you know, cut it, bend it, burn it, squash it, and it always comes back to its original shape. Maybe it's from one of those flying saucer things. So that's the story that Brazel took with him to Roswell. Maybe it's, you know, and so Wilcox, who later said it was the mistake of his life by calling the airbase first, he said he should have called the media first because the airbase covered it up. But he said, you know, Mac, if anything that comes from the sky, and it sounds like what you have there, it came from the sky, that's the purview of the Air Force. So let's call the air base, which was down 7 miles south of town at Roswell. And that's how the Air Force got involved. They send out Jesse Marcel, and Marcel takes Sheridan Cabot with him. They go out. They follow the rancher out. And this is on July the 6th. They stay overnight and hit the debris field on the 7th. And they're gathering up this stuff. And Cabot fills up his Jeep carryall. And he goes back to Roswell, the Roswell base, that day. Well, Marcel's still out there gathering up stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And he puts it in his 42 Buick. He fills it up, and this is late in the day, and on Sunday, I'm sorry, on, let's see, he got up there Sunday. This is early morning Sunday, and he heads back to town, back to Roswell, but before he gets to the base, he stops at home to show his son, Jesse Jr., and his wife, Vaud, because according to Jesse Jr., Marcel Sr., at that point, in his mind, it was a flying saucer. That's what his son said. His son said he was convinced at that point that his father thought it was a flying saucer, wreckage from a flying saucer. So into the base he goes with the wreckage, but he wanted to show his family first, which he did. Well, they have their meeting at the base, their morning meeting, and they're passing some of this material around. Whether it was, this is one of the points of contention, whether the first media press release was that, did that come from Blanchard or did that come from higher authority? And we always debate whether it was a local faux pas from Blanchard by putting out the story that they had captured, that's the term they used, the flying saucer. Or did that come from higher authority, like from the, not the president, but maybe General Vandenberg, who was acting chief of staff at that time. But anyway, they put out the first headline was, RAAF, that's Roswell Army Airfield, captures, and I guess that was some newspaper editing, flying saucer near Roswell region. And that's why it became the Roswell case and not the Corona case.
All right, stand by, Tom. We've got to take our break. Explanation. Thomas J. Carey is my special guest. We're talking about the Roswell crash, the Roswell incident, whatever you'd like to call it. His website, interesting website, www.roswellinvestigator.com. And we'll be back talking to Tom on the other side of this break as we continue here in the X-Zone with yours truly, Rob McConnell, from our broadcast center and studios in Fort Erie, Niagara, Canada. Don't go away.
wasn't right. I made love to Lane last night. When she gripped my hand, I was feeling mighty fine. But her fingers with mine would not intertwine. When I bent down and gazed into her eyes, they were big as donuts and blacker than the sky.
Welcome back, everyone. Thomas J. Carey is our special guest, and Thomas's website is RoswellInvestigator.com. A couple of questions for you, Tom. To the best of your knowledge, when the Air Force Marcel got to the ranch, did he take any photos of the debris field?
We don't know, Rob. We just don't know if he took a camera with him or not. He may have. Mm-hmm. We always have had rumors that somebody took pictures of it.
And right.
It's something that we've been looking for all these years and never came up with anybody that had them. So now, the answer is we don't know.
Okay.
So
isn't it out of the norm where an intelligence officer would go to a scene and not secure the scene and then bring everyone else to the scene in order not to break the chain of custody?
Well, this is something out of the ordinary. All that the rancher brought into town, mm-hmm, were two small boxes of pieces of wreckage. And, you know, the question was, what is this? And there's a whole pasture full of this stuff. You take Marcel out there, and he told Marcel, take whoever you want with him. Now, Marcel and Cabot were the two top intelligence people on the base. So it's not like they sent out two airmen, you know, yeah, a sergeant or an airman. These were the two top intelligence experts that went out to see what was there.
All right, but why didn't the sheriff go out?
Well, the sheriff ultimately, this was on a Sunday,
mm-hmm,
so his day, he's off, and he was unhappy that he had to come downstairs and interview Brazel, and he sent two of his deputies out.
Did the deputies take any photos?
I'm sorry?
Did the deputies take any photos?
Again, we don't know. We don't know. It's no one has ever said they took photos. Like I said, we've always, yeah, our ears have always been open for anybody that had some information about it. And quite frankly, nobody had any information about it.
All right. So let me ask you another question. Marcel puts some of the debris into his vehicle, and instead of going back to the base to maintain a proper chain of evidence custody, he decides to go home to show this material that he believed was from a UFO to his son. Now, doesn't that taint the credibility of this top intelligence officer when he breaks protocol?
It would if that was the only material, Rob, but there was a whole field full of it.
I understand that. But here you've got a supposedly well-trained intelligence officer who knows that you get from point A to point B in order to maintain the proper chain of custody of the material.
Well, they already had material from Cabot that brought
that
in.
Makes no difference. Cabot, that makes no difference.
A whole Jeep carryall full of the same material.
Yeah, I understand that. But why is the part
I can't read Marcel's mind on that.
I understand that. I understand that, Tom. But why is this part, you know, just paved over that Marcel did not follow proper protocol? This doesn't make him a hero. It makes him a suspect.
Well, we're not making him a hero. The reason that it's, in my mind, it's no, mm-hmm, big deal is because Cabot already delivered his metal, his material, and there was a whole sheep pasture full of the same material. So whether Marcel broke the chain of, yeah, custody did not diminish the story.
But why doesn't it diminish the story?
You have a field full of evidence.
But what you've got is a loose cannon of an intelligence officer going around saying that this is UFO material, bringing it home to show his kid. You know, and then, like you said, there's this whole field full of debris that has not been secured. So why does everybody why does everybody put so much faith in this Roswell case when it has more holes in it than a piece of cheese found in Billy Meyer's fridge?
Oh, that's not a hole. There's still a field of evidence out there. They did secure the site. They sent armed guards out there, and nobody could get to the site. It was secured. He made a stop on his way home. I'm guessing that he wanted to show his son, who was, I think, 11 years old at the time. At least that's what he said.
Yeah.
But it doesn't change the fact that there's a site full of strange material out there that the Air Force ultimately, very soon after they got back, secured. So okay, nothing's disturbed.
All right. So how many days after
that is being a hole?
How many days after Brazil was there to do his preliminary investigation, was the area secured by the military?
I'm sorry. What was the first part of that?
Okay. After Marcel went to the with Brazil and saw the debris field, picked up the debris with him and his counterpart, brought it back to the base. How long after the material was brought to the base was the site where the debris field was actually secured by the military?
Well, I forgot to mention that while Marcel and Cabot were out at the debris field site,
right?
That's the first main site. That's on the morning of Monday the 7th. They're out there at the site. The impact site was discovered, where the rest of the ship had come to rest, about 35 miles east-southeast of the debris field. It was discovered by some archaeologists. They called the sheriff, and the phone calls in those days, anytime they called the sheriff, it also went into the firehouse in Roswell.
Right.
So that's how some of the civilians got out to the impact site before the military did, because the military had just, because Marcel is still out there in the field. So they found out about this impact site north of town before Marcel got back. So they started securing the two sites that day. And I don't know, I couldn't tell you what time, but as soon as they could, because they had a meeting at the base office. Cabot was there, Marcel was there, all of Blanchard's direct reports, and that's when they decided this is a, you know, they put out the UFO, the flying saucer story, and they started deploying to the two sites at that point.
But how did they come to the conclusion that it was a UFO?
Well, it was at the time, Roswell was undergoing what we call a UFO flap. But the reason they came to the conclusion that it was a UFO was because at the impact site, there were three aliens, two dead, one still alive. That was a strange wreckage you can explain away. But the aliens, 3.5 feet tall, big heads, and they weren't human. They weren't human, so that's when they concluded that it wasn't anything from Earth.
Okay, so now we've got we've got two crash sites.
We have a third site that was discovered at some point between the two sites that I just told you about.
Okay.
When the ship exploded, apparently two of the occupants, beings or creatures, whatever you want to call them, when the ship exploded, two of them were blown out and came to rest. They met their demise at a small bluff about 2.5 miles east of the debris field site. They were discovered by Brazel either, and we don't know for sure, either before he went into town or afterwards. We're not exactly sure. But
wouldn't it make sense that it was after he went into town? Because when he went into town, he never mentioned a body. All he did was brought in, according to you, two boxes of this material.
Well, when we interviewed Frank Joyce, in 1998. Now, Joyce was the radio announcer that interviewed Brazel. It didn't go over the air, but he interviewed him over the telephone. And Brazel told him about this site that was 2.5 miles east. He said, boy, the smell is terrific. It made me sick. You know, what's going to happen? And he said, so Joyce says, what are you talking about? He says, oh, I forget what he called them, the little people. They were small and they were dead and they smelled terrible. What's going to happen to them? And so that's what Frank Joyce told us.
So was it Brazel who first mentioned the bodies?
To Frank Joyce, yes.
All right. So
at the same time, that's on the 6th. But on the 7th, they found the other site north of town where there were 2 dead and 1 alive. So by that time, they said this is not from us. Mm-hmm. This is not from the Russians. This is not from any other country on Earth.
How do we know that they actually found bodies?
Well, that's what the many witnesses have told us.
No disrespect, Tom, but you know, a lot of people believe in Santa Claus too. Like, when it comes to making a claim of extraterrestrials and crashed vehicles and so on, I understand the strength of the witnesses that you and Don and Kevin have talked to over the years, but here we are in the year 2021. This happened in 1947, and still, with all the investigations that have gone on, there hasn't been any physical evidence that's been turned up.
Well, if you no physical evidence, but testimony is evidence in a court of law. It can be evidence, and we've interviewed over 600 people. Mm-hmm. Not everybody knows the whole story. They only know their little piece. Mm-hmm. And what you do is you judge the witness, and you get to a point where you can pretty much tell what is the truth and what isn't when you're interviewing them, if you interview enough of them. And that's what we did. So
were all these witnesses were the main witnesses ever given a polygraph test?
I think Jesse Jr. was, or at least he had a, and I wasn't there, but he had a regressive hypnosis type.
But we all know that hypnosis isn't the best.
But you know, when we interviewed somebody, we don't have a polygraph ourselves, and you have to go to their house, and a lot of them are very uncomfortable. As far as a polygraph, I am unaware of that. Maybe there has been, maybe there hasn't. I don't know.
All right, stand by, Tom. You and I have to take our break at the bottom of the hour for the news. XO Nation, Thomas J. Carey is our guest. He's got 2 new books we're going to be talking about on the other side of this break. Roswell, the Chronological Pictorial, and Roswell, the Ultimate Cold Case Closed. This is the X Zone. I am Rob McConnell. We're coming to you from our broadcast center and studios in Fort Erie, Crystal Beach, which is part of Niagara in the province of Ontario. If you'd like to send me an email, xzone@xzoneradiotv.com, on all social media sites, X Zone Radio TV and the X Zone TV channel on SimulTV at www.simultv.com. Whatever you do, don't go away. We'll be back right after this news break. Explanation, Thomas J. Carey is our guest this hour, www.roswellinvestigator.com. All right, Tom, so as I understand it, there were three crash sites?
Yes.
Okay, and it was Mark Brazel who first reported the existence of the alleged ET bodies, right?
Yes, Matt Brazel.
Okay, now...
Mac Brazel.
Where was the largest debris field?
The largest debris field, or the largest crash site, was mm-hmm. the first one, the debris field site on the J.B. Foster Ranch.
And that's where Brazel was, right?
Yes.
Okay. So the evidence is whatever happened to the bodies, the E.T. bodies?
The E.T. bodies were... the ones that were dead mm-hmm. were flown to Wright-Patterson or Wright Field in Dayton, Ohio. And they remained there for, as near as we can tell from people who were there, until the early 1980s. And during that period, they were loaned around to various military hospitals for examination. And so we have a few stories like that where... doctors and officers had seen a body or two at this base or that base. So we, but Wright Field was the destination. The live one didn't go immediately to Wright Field. And the next, it turns up in April of the following year at Wright Field by a witness who saw it there. So that's where they went. Where they are today is anybody's guess. The last information we had was from a former commander at the Foreign Technology Division at the Wright-Patterson. When on his dying bed, he said that we have five aliens in Utah, which means Dugway would be the Dugway Proving Grounds. So that's our last best guess.
Now, are these five different aliens or the five aliens from the Roswell crash?
Well, we're assuming because there were five, mm-hmm. and he just mentioned five, that it, and this was some years ago.
I see.
And so we just assumed that those were the Roswell. But initially, they went to Wright Field for a number of years.
You know, in today's with today's technology and people breaking into data banks and you know, taking, you know, hacking and so on. If this information is hidden in a government database somewhere, and a country like China or Russia wanted to really embarrass the United States of America and prove to the American people that the government has been committing a conspiracy, thereby weakening the faith of the government, all they'd need to do is break into a... you know, a database and get the information and put it all over the place. And another thing that I find strange is that there's no mention of the Roswell crash in any of the WikiLeaks.
Any of the what?
The Roswell crash information or references to the Roswell crash or UFOs or extraterrestrials in anything that WikiLeaks has dumped.
WikiLeaks?
Yeah.
Boy, you got me there, Rob. I confess to ignorance okay. about WikiLeaks. I thought he was mostly political.
Well, wouldn't this be classified as political?
I don't think so. It's esoteric, but I wouldn't mm-hmm. say it's political.
Okay. All right. Maybe that's why. Maybe that's why I couldn't find any reference to it because it isn't political. So we're, you know, like when you, one of the titles of your book is Roswell, Roswell, the ultimate cold case closed. How did you close it?
Every book we've ever written, and this, that was the seventh book, we've mm-hmm. co-authored seven. Every one, I think, is the last one. And that was a few books ago. But because so many people were dead... And I can't think of any of the witnesses that we interviewed that are still alive.
Wow.
We just did a, you know, a encapsulated what our reminiscence about the case and where it, where it was, where it is, and where it might be going. And the case isn't closed. And we're writing a book now that will come out in June. And they were all already committed to a 2022 book, which will be the 75th, believe it or not, the 75th anniversary of the Roswell crash. We're going to have a sort of like a special book come out in honor of that. And I would expect that to be the last book.
I'm sure the town of Roswell will be having a major festivity and raking in the loot and having yes. all the dingbats there.
Yes, but I couldn't, you know, the only thing I can think of right now, because we in my own mind, we have the case nailed. The only thing that could happen would be a piece of wreckage that would come forward somehow.
All right, let me ask you this. What would happen if a piece of wreckage did come forward and it was found to be non-extraterrestrial but something from Earth? What would happen?
Well, it would be a terrestrial piece of wreckage.
Which would mean their crash had nothing to do with extraterrestrials, right?
How would we know that it came from the crash?
Well, what makes us think? Now, this is something that I've often wondered. How do we know that life on other planets would use the same, you know, like a craft that we could see instead of a craft that is totally made of material that we can't see? Or how do we even know that the extraterrestrials, if they're out there, are carbon-based and not based on another element? Like, what we're doing is we're being very self-righteous in thinking that, you know, we would be able to identify these craft or these extraterrestrials. We may be all wet.
Well, I don't see myself as being self-righteous, but we go by...
I meant the human race. I meant the human race here.
We're going by what the former commander at Wright-Patterson, General Exxon, who was the base commander, told us. And he had told us that, you know, because we say, you know, what was the ship made of? Well, you know, what was the, and he said this, he was told by the people that were there that analyzed the wreckage that it was mostly titanium, but with some other element where the processing was different.
Okay.
So that's what he told us. He was the commander at Wright-Patterson. We knew him and interviewed him several times. So, and the other thing, Rob, was that the most prevalent type of wreckage, and this is the type we would be looking for, because, you know, you can explain away wreckage as, oh, that was our latest fighter jet back in 1947, you know, something like that.
Sure.
But the most, what we're looking for and what we call our holy grail of Roswell is a piece of the so-called memory metal. This is the metal that has been described to us by a number of witnesses that it was ultra light. I mean, if you had it in your hand and wadded it up in your hand, it felt like you had nothing. But you would open your hand and it would just unfurl itself and sort of just float there. And it's very thin. You can't cut it, bend it, scratch it, burn it, do anything to it. That's what we're looking. That's what we're looking for, because we don't have anything close. Well, something close, but not nearly as good as the original. So, if someone would bring a piece of memory metal forward that we don't have to send out, and you never hear about it again, but something you can see visually that, hey, boy, that's really something out of this world. So, that's what we're looking for.
Okay.
Because a piece of metal, a piece of metal, even if it was like one of the stiff parts of the ship, you know, some of the metal was was not like that. It was stiff. Mm-hmm. You could take a sledgehammer to it, and it wouldn't even, you know, sledgehammer would bounce off. That you can explain away, but this memory metal, you can't explain that away. Looking at it.
How many witnesses actually saw this folding metal, or what did you call it? Memory metal.
We haven't added them up, but there's a lot. There's a lot. And there's a lot of witnesses that were out at the site cleaning up the sites, the three sites. And they always say, oh, by the way, I saw bodies there. There were bodies there. So they, you know, well, what did they look like? And they give us the classic description. And these people are all gone now. But, you know, we interview each one. We judge each one. And you can even tell during their story if they wander off into something they've seen on television, mostly, you sort of discount that. But, you know, and there's some that just outright were making it up, and we can tell that right away. So if you interview enough people.
All right, so we've got five extraterrestrials. And if a spacecraft did crash, and if a spacecraft can, you know, withstand space travel,
why did it crash?
Exactly.
We get that question all the time. And anything that's manufactured has a tensile, you know, something like a metal, you know, metallic item. Mm-hmm. Anything like that has a tensile strength, meaning pulling it apart. And if you exceed the tensile strength, it'll come apart. And these were manufactured with some form of elements. General Exxon says titanium was one big element in it. But if something happens where it exceeds the tensile strength, it'll come apart. And whether it was an internal explosion, whether it was struck by radar, not radar, it was struck by lightning, we don't know. We just can only speculate. But it came apart over Brazel's sheep pasture. The inner cabin is what we think withstood the blast, continued on for another 35 miles and came to rest just north of Roswell. And that's where what we call the impact site, where there were two dead and one still alive. So to answer your question, every manufactured piece of material has a tensile strength.
But once again, Tom, I've got to take my final break here, but quickly. But once again, we're basing the knowledge and the technology that we know of here on this planet. If these people are extraterrestrial, shouldn't they be further ahead? And isn't it possible that our law of physics do not apply to them?
How would we know? I wouldn't know.
Exactly. How would we know? How would we know anything at this point? Because... you know, it's a great story.
Interview enough people and you know something.
Yeah. We'll be back on the other side of this break. Don't go away. And welcome back, everyone. Thomas J. Carey is our special guest this hour. Thomas has two new books out, Roswell, the Chronological Pictorial, and Roswell, the Ultimate Cold Case Closed. And for more information about Thomas and his work, his books, and so on, visit his website at roswellinvestigator.com. We were talking about the Roswell incident, and there are so many questions that that are unanswered with this. It seems that there are a lot of investigators that are still looking into it, like yourself, Don Schmidt, and of course Kevin Randall, and many others. With all the people that are looking into it, and I'm sure there are thousands, including the armchair investigators that surf the internet for information that somebody might have missed. How come we're no closer to getting that all important and necessary piece of physical evidence to define definitely what this case is all about?
Well, that's the final question, because mm-hmm. we suspect there are pieces out there, because out in that territory, whenever they had a plane crash, the civilians always got there first.
Sure.
And the civilians go out there and they pick up pieces as souvenirs, mm-hmm. and we're sure that's what happened in this case, because the civilians got there first.
Yeah.
We've heard stories that so-and-so has a piece, there's a piece there, there's so-and-so has a piece, and so far it hasn't materialized.
Yeah.
Not to use a pun, but
that was a good one.
It's one of the big disappointments of the case, but I'm confident that at someday, and this sounds mm-hmm. like pie in the sky, but along the trajectory, Rob, from where the ship exploded to where the final impact site was, along that trajectory, there were pieces, no doubt, falling off the ship. So, but that's a big desert out there, and it's 75 years almost since this happened. So that's unlikely that it's going to come that way. And we believe that one of those Corona ranchers, one of these days, is going to turn up something. But it's a long shot.
Yeah.
I agree with you. But that's the only missing piece to this case. Again, not to use another pun, but
sure.
That's the missing piece.
All right. But do you find it strange that Jesse Marcel himself hadn't kept a piece, because he did bring it home, you're showing it to his kid, and if he really thought it was part of UFO, and there was this massive debris field, and there was already stuff at the base, why didn't he keep a piece?
Well, we don't know that he didn't keep a piece. Mm-hmm. Well, there is a story that he did, and that he kept the piece in the water heater in his house in Houma, Louisiana. There was also another story, and we tried to follow up on this, that he and Sheridan Cabot had a piece, and they were over Marcel's house, and the wives were talking, and Marcel and Cabot went into the kitchen. They started cooking it up to see if they could get it to do something, destroy it, meld it, whatever. And somebody said, you shouldn't have that piece of metal. And so they went out back where they had just poured a patio. And when they came back, they didn't have the piece. So all these years, we've been thinking that maybe there's a piece under the Marcel patio still. The only problem is that the patio is no longer out back. It's part of the inside of the house. And we offered to buy the house so that we could, do a Geraldo Rivera type case, and dig up the patio, but the owner wouldn't sell, and it's still possibly still there. But that's one story about Marcel. The other one is that he had kept the piece, took it when he retired to Houma, Louisiana. He had a piece, and he kept it in an old water heater, which is long gone, of course. But that's the two stories we heard about Marcel. and the his possibly keeping a piece of the wreckage. You would think he would, but that's as close as we got. We also had a story where Walter Hout, the public information, had a piece at his house, and it was I won't tell you where he kept it because we still have plans to try to do something about that. And those are the stories that come to mind. And but we believe that there are military personnel who were able to pocket a piece, and certainly some of the civilians that got out there before the military took a souvenir or two. And it's a long shot, I agree. And we can only hope that somebody comes forward and it's a piece of the memory medal and not some of the other stuff where you can say, oh, that's just a piece of metal. Where the memory medal, you can see that it's different.
I'm going to ask you a hypothetical question here. What, in your opinion, what would ufology be like today if Stanton Friedman had not brought this story forward?
That's a great question because, you know, for me, Rob, when I read the book, The Roswell Incident, all the other UFO stories just faded away. This Roswell story was for me the UFO story of all time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, being on it for 30 years, I mean, what have you done, you know, for 30 years to be so interested in something like that? But it's the best case as far as interest, the story. And there are a couple other UFO cases that are interesting. I'm interested in, but nothing like this. And if there hadn't been a Roswell case, what case would it be? I don't know, Rendlesham or Westall in Africa. I'm sorry, Australia or Zimbabwe in Africa. Two good cases.
What was it that got you interested in ufology?
I was always it was the thought of somebody living somewhere else. You know, somebody living not on the earth, but somewhere else, and they're visiting us, and they don't look like they're hominoids, but they're not us. And it was the thought of somebody else out there, and that's the interest. And the fact that the Roswell case, we're talking about not lights in the sky that dart around or tic tacs that go back and forth, but a real corporeal, or however you pronounce it, corporeal, a physical wreckage to the case, and then bodies. The case has everything. It's got a cover-up. It's got death threats.
It's a great story.
Yes.
But once again,
that's what blew me away when I read the Roswell Incident book.
I agree with you. It's a great story, but it's based on
It's based
stories.
On testimony. It's based on testimony. Very few documents, because they gathered up all of the evidence, and one of the airmen at the base, Patrick Saunders, was so proud that he was given the task of destroying all evidence, you know, documentary evidence of the incident, and. He told his daughter, and she told us. And
so you didn't hear this firsthand?
No, we heard it from his daughter.
Oh, okay. A lot of people get their 5 minutes of fame from talking about the Roswell incident, or claiming to be witnesses, or claiming to have knowledge of it. This is why I hear you when you talk about, you know, witnesses and testimony, but there's no smoking gun.
Well, if you're talking about a piece of physical evidence, you're correct. There's no physical piece of evidence that we have that we can point to that we have recovered.
Yeah.
And as I say, testimony has sent people to the electric chair when they had electric chairs.
Mm-hmm.
But if it's credible, is evidence in a court of law.
I understand what you're saying, Tom, and I understand the enthusiasm of you people who are into the UFO phenomenon, and people who you know, who really
believe. I'm not into the UFO phenomenon. I'm into, like I said, Roswell is, you know, you remember the movie The Verdict with Paul Newman?
No, I don't. I'm sorry.
He was handling a case and his sidekick said, take the money, take the money. He mm-hmm. says, no. He says, there'll be other cases. He says, no, this is the case. This is the only case. And that's my feeling about
it. Yeah, I understand that. But Paul Newman was portraying a lawyer, if I'm correct, who was, it had something to do with a criminal case. But we're talking about,
it was the principal. It was the principal that he had other cases. Mm-hmm. You know, just take the money on this one. He said, no, this is the case. This is the only case that I want to work on. So that was it.
So this
and that's
is
how I feel about Roswell.
So what's your next step in proving or disproving it?
Well, it's pretty hard for us to. You can't prove a negative. We don't need any more witnesses. This is, you know, sort of a confession here. Mm-hmm. We don't need any more witnesses. Plus, we don't know that any are still alive. But it'd be nice to have a piece of physical wreckage that we've been talking about tonight. And that would be the cap the case. That would be it if we could get a piece of memory metal.
And if a piece of physical evidence is never found, what does that do to the case?
I'm sorry, we don't have a piece. No,
I know. But what I was saying is, what happens if a piece is never found?
If it's never found,
yeah.
Well. I guess you'll believe what you know. You'll think what you think, and mm-hmm. I believe what I believe because I believe right now that we have the evidence that whether it was extraterrestrial or extratemporal or something like that, a ship crashed in 1947.
Wouldn't it be more fair to say that something crashed?
Well, the bodies that people talk about make it suggest they ship.
It's very suggestive, right? But what about Project Mogul?
Project Mogul falls apart like a cheap suit when you examine it.
And there are many people who believe in Project Mogul who feel that Roswell falls apart very easily too. So once again, I think it's what you want
Project
to believe.
Project Mogul is nobody. Mm. We have no witness to a balloon event in Brazos Pasture at that time. We have none, zero witnesses to a balloon event.
All right, Tom, I hate to do this, but we've run out of time for tonight. And Exo Nation, if you'd like to get more information about Thomas Carey and his quest, his crusade on finding out or proving to the world that the crash of Roswell, of who knows what it was, really did happen, visit his website at www.roswellinvestigator.com. www.roswellinvestigator.com. But, I'm going to tell you something. I there are so many holes in this story, and my biggest bone of contention with this whole thing, everybody puts Jesse Marcel, you know, right up on the altar because he's the base intelligence officer. Well, a base intelligence officer should have been smarter and used a lot more intelligence when handling what was supposed to have been. And once again, we don't know what it was. But he... and others believe it was a UFO. We'll be back on the other side of this break. Don't go away.